It's been a while.
It's been a while. Our last episode was Top Gun. That was a question, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, it was.
Our last episode was Top Gun, a movie you very much enjoyed, and mm-hmm. a movie that I was okay with at my time. In that time, we did discover that most of what Tom Cruise did in that movie would have got landed him in prison and, on a few occasions, executed for treason. Mm-hmm. And, like, inciting a war. So, you know, Top Gun. But it's a special day because some Guillermo del Toro movement has occurred mm-hmm. in the old pop culture verse. What happened today?
His Pinocchio trailer dropped.
Yes, we got our first real trailer.
We got to see the dope, the dope fairy looking.
The dope,
she looks pretty cool.
The dope blue fairy. So yeah, mm-hmm. Guillermo del Toro's Netflix production of Pinocchio, which we have discovered today, will be launched in theaters in November. So fingers crossed, you and I will be able to maybe go see it on the big screen. Mm-hmm. Fingers crossed. Chrissy Cross.
Yeah.
Yeah, another big screen appearance. Otherwise, we'd have to wait till December to watch it mm-hmm. streaming. But I find it fortuitous that that dropped today mm-hmm. because I find many parallels between Guillermo del Toro's obsession with Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And Hayao Miyazaki's obsession with a particular work of fiction. And they are probably the two of the most similar as far as the directors we've covered in this mm-hmm. In this podcast. Mm-hmm. So why does Guillermo del Toro keep making Frankenstein?
Why does anyone keep making anything?
This Pinocchio is, it's Frankenstein. He has mm-hmm. rewritten it to be Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pinocchio is a lot less terrifying than Frankenstein is, though.
Is he? He's got that nose.
Yeah, but he's made of wood. You could just set him on fire.
That's
you could
true.
Set Frankenstein on fire, too, but he's also, like, terrifying.
Fun fact.
He's made of dead bodies.
One of the first things that happens in the novel of Pinocchio is Pinocchio gets set on fire.
Good. Yeah, that makes sense. If a talking wooden boy came up to you, what would you do?
Well, he doesn't get set on fire by someone. He sets himself on fire accidentally. Not it's like a protest or anything. He's resting his feet by the fire. He falls asleep. Like, it's a puppet. I don't know how that works. But he falls asleep. And he wakes up and his feet have been burned off and he screams for his father, Geppetto, to save him, who has to carve him some new feet. Not unlike that mouse book where the mouse takes off his feet. but yeah, so this trailer it's a teaser's trailer, so we don't get any like music or anything. We mostly get narration by the cricket, voiced by Ewan McGregor. But it's mm-hmm. it's very much about like Geppetto seems to have lost a child, I guess, mm-hmm. is where they're doing with this. And he's created Puppet Boy to be his, like, surrogate son. And then the freaky blue fairy bestows it with life.
What I got from the trailer, which could be completely wrong because it's a trailer, is that somehow he got a soul. And the blue fairy's like, we've seen this happen before. Good luck.
Not again. I hope it's a direct reference to Frankenstein. Oh, she's like, there was this monster man just a few years back in England.
Well, the whole point of Frankenstein is that he didn't have a soul.
I think the problem with Frankenstein, he has too much soul. He's blessed.
He has criminal brain.
Yes, that's right. but it is very much not the novel of Pinocchio. In the Pinocchio novel, the wood is alive. It's a living piece of wood that's already a jerk before it gets carved. Like, mm-hmm. he carves like a face in it, and the wood's like, ha ha, screw off. And he's like, you naughty boy, I'm going to make you a body so I can spank you. It's basically like and then the Pinocchio is just a jerk for like 95% of the novel. And at the very end, he's like, I want to be a real live boy. And they make him a boy for no reason. Like, it's not the plot. In any case, Pinocchio. It's going to have music songs in it.
Good.
Singing and dancing.
I look forward to that in a Guillermo del Toro movie.
Yeah, a musical Guillermo del Toro? Great. Throw it at me. But that is not the movie we are discussing this week.
No.
This week, and I've got a little setup here. This week, we are discussing our first Hayao Miyazaki movie, our first Studio Ghibli movie. And for a little bit of a... I mean, if you look at the title of the episode, you know what it is. But the fun part is that this is a movie about a boy in a future world that has been devastated by environmental impact and war, how he comes across a mysterious young girl from another land who is the key to rediscovering lost technology, but is being pursued by evil agents of that other land and also pirates, and how they have to work together to rediscover the technology, find the lost world, and become friends in the process. And I am, of course, discussing the Hayao Miyazaki project, Future Boy Conan. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. No, I am discussing the Hayao Miyazaki produced work, Nadia, The Secret of Blue Water. No, wait, I'm sorry. I'm discussing Disney's Atlantis, The Lost Empire. No, wait, I'm sorry. I'm discussing... Of course, I'm talking about Laputa, Castle in the Sky, but this is like the second or third iteration of this story that Miyazaki worked on.
It's a good story.
It's a good story.
It's also an important story.
It's an important story, or as we say, as shorthand, it's instortant.
We've never said that ever.
It's instortant. That's an important story. So Hayao Miyazaki, in case you're not familiar...
In case you're not familiar, we're one of the greatest filmmakers of all time.
In case you've never heard of the man, he was born in 1941 in Tokyo, and when he was a teenage boy, he saw the first Japanese animated motion picture, which was a retelling of the White Snake story that he fell in love with and was like, I want to do this for the rest of my life. He became a manga artist in high school, but he wanted to animate. He saw the Russian film of the Snow Queen as a teenager and was like, animation's the way to go. You can pretty much move audiences to tears and tell any story you want in animation. And to that end, he started working for Toei Animation as an in-betweener, kind of worked his way up through the ranks. And he started working on some pretty big projects, particularly for television. Now, in 1970, Alexander Key, the author of Escape to Witch Mountain, published a novel called The Incredible Tide that Hayao Miyazaki read and was like, this is going to be my next project. And it is the story of a future world with lost technology, a boy raised in a more primitive society who finds a mysterious young girl who is the key to rediscovering and unlocking the old tech in order to rebuild the world again, who is pursued by evil representatives of the advanced civilization, yada yada yada. And he adapted that into the TV series Future Boy Conan. He then later used elements of it for Nausicaa.
I love that movie.
Fantastic movie, fantastic manga series.
I have the manga series. Matt got it for me.
It's phenomenal.
I know. It's so good.
But again, you can see where like that theme is also true in Nausicaa. Like, we destroyed our world. There's technology hidden, lost to the ages. Humanity
Look,
having
don't,
to...
Don't dump on that theme. It's what I want my
no,
next
it's
novel
great.
Is. It is novel I'm working on about.
Literally the basis of all of Miyazaki's work. Mm-hmm. The balance of nature and technology, humankind answering for its sins against nature.
I love the idea of a future full of incredible technology that's just sitting around and can't be used.
Yes. Yeah.
And using it as like a bowl.
Using
this computer, a bowl.
This computer is now a butt rest, a chair.
Yep.
I am resting my butt in the future computer bowl. He also was obsessed with a manga artist named Tetsuji Fukushima, who wrote a manga called The Demon Desert, Desert of the Devil, Desert of the Demon, that he read when he was a kid and was like, I basically just want to do this. I want to do what this guy's done. And I would say that like Incredible Tide and Desert of the Devil are like, if you smash those things together with a bunch of other influences, you have Miyazaki. You have his work. He also
incredible looking animated food.
Oh, we'll get to that because there is some of that in this one. What's funny is he directed a bunch of episodes of the TV series of Lupin the Third. He did a lot of design work and writing on those. And there's an episode of it called Farewell, O Dearest Lupin, that has a giant robot in it that he pretty much just was like, this is the robot I'm using in Castle of the Sky. So the robot from Castle of the Sky literally first appeared in the exact same form in the TV series Lupin the Third. It's pretty funny if you look at the pictures of it. You're like, oh, wow, that's a Miyazaki robot right there. There it is. There's the...
It's the robot.
It's the it's just the robot. He was like, I like this robot. I'm going to use this robot again. So he uses it again. But yeah, he is a elements from these stories go on to appear in Totoro, in Ponyo, in it's everything the man touches. But this is the first Studio Ghibli film. Mm-hmm. He had done Nausicaä. It was super successful. He wanted to make another movie, but not yet. They wanted a sequel to Nausicaä. He said no. Mm-hmm. So his next project was going to be a movie. I'm a little shaky on what the story was going to be, but it was going to be an anime about the Yanagawa canals in Yanagawa. And he had visited Yanagawa. He had seen the canals, and he wanted to do this story about high school boys and girls growing up in Yanagawa. And so his producer went to go take a look and was so blown away by it that he came back and was like, no, you're not going to make an anime about this. I'm going to make a documentary about this. But no one would give him the money. So Miyazaki took the money they had made from Nausicaä to fund this documentary about, it's called The Story of Yanagawa's Canals. It's available to watch online. Mm-hmm. But Ghibli did animated sequences for it, basically about how the canals work. And it's actually pretty cool. It's like 30 minutes long. But because of that, they didn't have the funds that they wanted because they had spent them all on this canals documentary.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes things are more important.
Yep. They were casting around for ideas, and Miyazaki had this sort of like spin-off concept from Future Boy Conan running around in his head. He had wanted to do an adaptation of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. So he had all these ideas going around in his head. He wanted to do this movie called Around the World Under the Sea that he was developing. This was before Future Boy Conan, but he took ideas for that, put them in Future Boy Conan. He couldn't get that project off the ground, so he started retooling this idea. And he created Nadia, The Secret of Blue Water, which ended up being produced years later by Gainax, the people who did Evangelion. But it was based on his ideas. Nadia, did you ever watch Nadia, The Secret of Blue Water?
No.
I had a bunch of them when you were a little kid, and I get them confused with this movie because I was watching them at the same time. It's basically the same story as this, just it's a long series, down to some of the exact same imagery.
Yeah.
So he wanted to do that. He was throwing a bunch of ideas together, and he came up with the idea based on Gulliver's Travels, based on a bunch of other sources. So he went to Wales. He saw the miners' strike in Wales. And he was like, okay, I want to do a thing in a mining town. I want this to be set in a mining town. I want it to look like this Welsh mining town. These miners remind me of the miners, the coal miners in Japan. I want that to be a huge influence. And you can just kind of see how Miyazaki was just like taking all these like social and political and artistic influences and mushmashing them all together into the movie we're going to watch today, Castle in the Sky. I almost called it Valley of the Wind.
It is not Valley of the Wind, although I would not mind watching that movie. What is your favorite Miyazaki film?
Let's talk about that after we watch this one.
Okay.
Let's talk about that body, because this one is called...
I haven't seen this movie in so long. I'm really excited to see it again.
This is Laputa, Castle in the Sky, or as it is known in most of the world, Castle in the Sky, because Laputa, or Laputa, is Spanish for the whore, which he took from Gulliver's Travels. For the floating city in Gulliver's Travels, which was an intentional joke in that very adult novel, satirical novel, but that went over the head of the Japanese speakers, not realizing that's a dirty joke. So
we discussed this in the ending of our last episode.
Yes. Worldwide, this movie, the name is pronounced Laputa to keep it from sounding like a dirty joke. And the title is just shortened to Castle in the Sky. The version we are going to watch, in case the audience is interested, is not the original Japanese dub, but also not the Disney dub. Mm-hmm. We're going to watch the original streamline animation dub, which I find fascinating because you can't get it anymore. But it has...
How did you get it?
You can't get it anymore. you can just get the sound, like the sound file, and just lay it over the thing. So... But it contains, when Disney released this movie, they had Joe Hisaishi, the composer for almost all Ghibli's films, to write more and more reorchestrated score for it. Because they were like, modern audiences want more music in their movie. They also added a ton of dialogue, more jokes, more asides, just to sort of fill in the quiet space. I want to watch the movie as close to the original Japanese as possible, but because of our problems with subtitling, I want to also watch this old dub, just to sort of get the feel.
What problems with subtitling?
Because our subtitles are always wonky, and sometimes they're not completely on the screen.
That's true.
And I just find this, I find this kind of a neat halfway point between the original and the modern version, this sort of like lost version of this movie that kids would have seen in the 80s if they had rented this at their local video store. Well, this is the longest intro we've ever done.
It's an important intro. I want to say that Miyazaki is a really big influence on my art and a lot of other facets of my creative life, like D&D and stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited.
I'm super excited. I'm excited for this to be our first Miyazaki film. We will be watching one more. But
which one are we watching?
Totoro.
Yeah, boy.
Totoro, which I've seen so many times.
100,000 times. I've seen Castle in the Sky. I spent a year watching Princess Mononoke like 6 times every day. Seen Nazca Valley of the Wind 100,000 times. Seen My Neighbor Totoro 100,000 times. I saw the weird one with the cats. At Olivia's house at a sleepover. I think I've seen more. I just can't remember. Ponyo I saw in the theaters.
You saw in the theaters with me. Yeah. We saw Howl's Moving Castle in the theater together.
Yeah. I think we've also watched that outside of the theater. I saw Kiki's Delivery Service.
Do we see The Secret World of Arrietty? Yes.
Yes.
We saw that in the theater.
Yeah. I saw Kiki's Delivery Service. I'm sure I've seen more because you really liked him and I just watched whatever you were watching.
Right. I just kind of had him on. I had this bootleg Japanese DVD set of all the Ghibli films like up to like 2001 or something. Mm-hmm. So like, which was like pretty, it was a totally just like janky release and the picture was terrible, but you could watch stuff that hadn't been released yet in America. So in any case, we've been going on for 20 minutes. Let's watch A Castle in the Sky.
Let's do it. You can tell how much we love Miyazaki by how long this intro is.
Oh yeah, I'm Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And it's Del Toro time.
Miyazaki time, actually.
It is Miyazaki time.
Goodbye. What a terrible movie.
What a terrible movie. We all hated it. We were so angry the whole time. When will this movie end? We were shouting to the heavens. That's a great movie.
It's a fantastic movie.
I have a question for you.
Yeah, ask away.
And this question is, of course, basically a statement on my part, but is this one of the best action films of the 80s?
I mean, I have no idea. I haven't seen a lot of 80s action films.
I would go so far as to say this is one of the best action movies out there from the 1980s. It is pretty much nonstop action the whole way through.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of sitting and absorbing the world like there is a lot of Miyazaki films.
You get some downtime where you kind of establish what's going on and who these people are, but then it's just right back into trains derailing and planes a-flying and castles crumbling out of the sky.
And a lot of explosions.
A lot of explosions. A lot of yelling.
A lot of guns pointed at children.
Yes, a lot of children having their faces shot by guns. A boy gets his face shot by a gun.
Yep.
And we're just like, that happens. That wouldn't happen in The Rescuers Down Under, I tell you what, mate.
Also, that wouldn't happen in real life because he would just be dead.
He would not. You can get winged by a bullet. He would just be dead. You could be grazed by a bullet. That is a thing that
occurs.
You're
more likely to get your face shot off.
I mean, if he had been like a half an inch further over, that would have been the end of our hero. Our little boy hero. Who is a little boy, because we did end up watching, after some confusion, we did end up watching the streamlined dub in which our main character, or I say our main character, in which one of our two main characters is actually portrayed by a at least young-sounding actor, as opposed to the Disney dub, in which Patsu is played by a very adult James Vanderbeek.
What's her face? Shita also sounds more childish, I think.
Oh yeah, no, they both sound, because Anna Paquin plays Shita in the Disney dub. Our voice actors in this dub are Patsu is played by Bertha Green. Mm-hmm. Bertha Green. Mm-hmm. An English actress, which is interesting. Also played some did voices in Kiki's Delivery Service, the original dub, and Castle of Cagliostro. Oh, and Go Panda Go, one of Miyazaki's early movies that he worked on. And Shida is played by Louise Chambel. Louise Chambel.
Two good names.
Who played female motorist in My Neighbor Totoro, the original Troma dub. So Louise Chambel. Oh, but now known in professionally as Laura Ann Cody. So Laura Ann Cody, formerly credited as Louise Chambel.
All right.
And those are our two. Those are our two main voice actors that we thought to do. I liked this dub. I actually liked this dub a lot.
Yeah, so did I.
Yeah, it sounded like classic anime dub from the 80s. So, you know, your old women sounded like this. And your old men sounded like this. And we loved it that way.
Yes. And our main guy sounded like Ash Ketchum.
Yes, because we're classic anime dub where all little boys were voiced by women in their 30s doing a little boy voice, as it should be. Because what are little boys but just 30-year-old women waiting to happen? I don't know. I don't know what's going with that. He sounded far more like a little boy than James Vanderbeek, who talks. James Vanderbeek's voice in the Disney dub is this. He talks like this. He sounds like a guy.
He just sounds like a dude.
Yeah. So these little kids seem much younger in this version and far more in danger.
Yes.
And we also got far less score in this movie because we did not hear the Disney dub that had far more score. I liked the silence.
So did I. I liked the trumpet solo.
Yes. Yeah, Pazu plays the trumpet at one point, and in the Disney dub, it's like fully orchestrated. Like this, like swelling. It's like this good morning music, and in the original, it's just a kid on a trumpet.
Yep. Sounds better than most kids on trumpets, to be fair.
What else does he have to do? He practices the trumpet. He lives in a mining town.
And builds airplanes.
He does, okay. He has his airplane to build, his trumpet to practice. Kids got a full day. Oh, and like, I guess 18 hours down in a mine.
Also,
kids got a full day.
Taking care of his birds.
He does have birds. He has pigeons. Or doves, as you said, is in the Disney version?
I think so. I remember them being called doves, but I haven't seen the Disney version in a while.
They are clearly doves, which are a kind of pigeon. So
yeah, they're just pigeons.
They're just white pigeons, but these are white pigeons. Mm-hmm. For some reason, it makes it seem it's a little more professional with them being called pigeons, I think. You know, like, these are my working pigeons.
Mm-hmm.
Are they working
also,
pigeons?
I don't know. They get up in the morning and they fly around.
That's their job.
Dove always sounds so, like, adult. Like, the word dove. I just can't imagine a child actually saying that.
A dove. The first time I ever had semi-decent chocolate, it was Dove chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
I got it from a grocery store when I was in high school, and I was like, let's see what this is all about. And I tried it, and I was like, oh, there actually is good chocolate in the world. and I was never the same after that. So, yeah, so let's talk about 1986's Castle in the Sky and how it is almost the quintessential Studio Ghibli film.
Do you want me to start with something?
Start with something. Tell me something. Tell me what you got.
It has a robot in it.
It has a robot.
It has several hundred robots in it.
It's got a lot of
robots. They fly through the sky.
They do. They are winged? Armored? They have arms that become wings?
They have gliders.
Yeah. How do you describe these robots? Their arms aren't like human
arms.
They're
Dorito shaped.
They're Dorito shaped, by which you mean triangle shaped. They have arms though that are segmented, but not like segmented
they
like
have,
our
like,
arms.
Their arms are like centipedes.
Yes, that's what it is. They kind of like fold up and down with their many segments. And they grow wings. And they fly, and they have funny little faces.
And then they get all on all fours, and they're terrifying. And
they are terrifying. They crawl around all fours. When they crawl around all fours, it's like in any horror movie when the creepy child or the possessed person suddenly, like, hunches over and starts scuttling around like a crab. And you're like, nope, nope. That's exactly what these guys are like. They're very intimidating. And they speak in bleeps and bloops.
Yes.
Yeah. They don't have cute voices.
They do not. Yeah. They have beep boops.
Yeah, so the movie begins on an airship called the Saturn, which flies in the air. Everything in this movie flies. This is all about
it
flying.
It doesn't really fly. It's more of a propel type thing.
Wait. Are you insisting
it's
we
prop-
did Do we differentiate between things that fly and things that are propelled?
Because no, I just wanted to bring up the propellers.
They are
yes. I have a weird thing about, because for me, flying is like how birds fly and airplanes are a different thing, but whatever.
I should say that the movie actually begins with like that. Does it begin with the mural, or is that after, is there a prologue and then the mural? Does she fall and then we see the big like opening sequence, or
I can't remember. It's a big opening sequence.
There is this beautiful like sequence that's a mural, mm-hmm. and if you pay very close attention to it, which, you know, you might not because you're just kind of like blown away and overwhelmed by everything that's happening in front of you. It tells the story of what is happening, of what happened to get everyone where they are today. It tells the entire history of Laputa and the land below. And it's very abstract, very hard to follow. It happens after she falls. It happens as she's falling. Like it cuts between her falling. So you're kind of just thrown into this movie where there's this young girl on this airship that's being raided by sky pirates, who are the coolest sky pirates in the world.
Skyrits, if you will.
Yep, the Skyrits raid the airship. And those pirates will come back, and they will be main characters.
They will be the best.
But the girl on the airship is not happy to be on the airship.
No.
She has a necklace, and the necklace is important.
She has Kiki Delivery's dress on.
Yep, she looks like Kiki from Kiki's Delivery Service, and she escapes out of the side of the airship, and then she falls and plummets to the ground below. And that's when we get the mural, the sort of like...
She really does commit violence in the first 5 minutes of this movie, which is very good.
Amazing violence.
She beats a guy over the head with a bottle and jumps out a window.
Yeah, our villain, ladies and gentlemen, the man with a plan, the man we love to hate, or the man we hate.
Do you think he was a completely reasonable person and then he got like super concussed from the bottle being smashed on the
head? right. He had a pretty reasonable plan and then she smashed him over the head. No, I think he's just an SOB and deserves everything that comes to him.
Yep.
His name is Muska. Mm-hmm. And
he has dumb glasses.
He has dark glasses that he wears all the time. They are prescription sunglasses, as we learn, because he cannot see without them.
Or maybe I was thinking that maybe he had like the explosion happened and the glass like went in his eye and blinded him or something.
Right.
Which is much more violent than what you said.
Miyazaki described him as a man who is not quite finished. He joined the military because he has ambition, but he has a serious complex about something. And boy, oh boy, does he. So he's pretty much just the villain for the most of the movie, who is after this necklace that belongs to this young girl, Shida. You presumed in order just to get technology and to get gold, but we learned later on that he has ulterior motives.
Who would have thought?
Yeah. The pirates are led by Dola.
Mm-hmm.
Who is...
I kept thinking of her name as Dula, and I was like, that is not what her name is. That is a completely different thing.
Right. I believe that her name is actually Dora, which makes sense. Like, that's an actual name that we've heard of, Dora. Mm-hmm. But the RL confusion in the Japanese pronunciation has led to her just being referred to as Dola, and that's how she is referred to in the dub.
Yeah.
And they call her Dola in the dub.
As she's called most frequently. Nah, never mind.
What?
I was going to say, I don't like saying mommy. It makes me feel really weird.
No. Yeah, she has these adult, large adult sons who hang out with her. Well, they are her pirates.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them calls her mommy
a lot.
No,
several of them call her mommy the entire time.
They call her mommy. And yeah, she is. Yeah, it's gross. She is voiced in the movie by, in the version we saw, by Rachel Van Owen, but in the Disney dub by Cloris Leachman, who pretty much sounds like Rachel Van Owen in this dub. Like, she's just doing a cranky old woman, like, in the movie, and she does a good job at it.
I love her as a character. I love all old women in Miyazaki films, to be completely honest,
because
they're all great.
Yeah, and I believe that Porco Rosso also has a band of pirates led by a woman like this. So like this, and like, and it's like a bunch of like bumbling big boys and like this woman leading the pirate group, who attack a ship full of little schoolgirls who become probably the greatest force of chaos in a Miyazaki film. These little schoolgirls that these pirates are trying to wrangle. It's one of the funniest things ever committed to a Miyazaki film. And Porco Rosso is, of course, one of the greatest Studio Ghibli films ever made. And has some amazing sky piracy in it itself. But this movie is all about sky piracy, amazing flying, and
how much the military sucks.
How much the military absolutely sucks. Yeah, Miyazaki.
This is the opposite of the last movie we watched.
Right. This is like Top Gun, very enamored of flying. Mm-hmm. Unlike Top Gun, has no place for the military. Surprisingly enough, famously anti-military filmmaker Hayao Miyazaki has no patience for the military.
Who would have thought?
There is a bunch of greedy fools who get what's coming to them by a bunch of killer robots.
This is really a killer robot movie, isn't it?
It does turn into a killer robot movie just on a dime. It just becomes a killer robot movie. So this little girl, Sheeta, falls out of an airship. Her magic necklace springs to life and carries her floating down to the ground.
Her levitation stone.
Yes, they refer to it as the levitation stone. I believe in the Disney dub they call it like the magic crystal or something. But it's a stone.
Just like the crystal or something, yeah.
Yeah, this thing is a stone. It looks like a rock.
Yep, with a thing carved in it.
And she had no idea this thing was magic.
No.
Even though, as we've learned later on.
She had some idea it was.
It was important to her.
Yeah.
But and she knew it was valuable, but she
and
didn't.
She wasn't supposed to take it out of the fireplace.
Right. She never knew it was going to cause her to be able to float down. Mm-hmm. It makes you float down. It's basically it's magic power. It's surprising she didn't suspect it was magic, though, because as we find out later,
she's magical with magic spells.
She knows all kinds of magic spells, I guess.
Healing spells, fixing spells, destruction spell. Mm-hmm.
And why does she know the destruction spell?
To help balance out the good magic.
Yeah. So she saves it till the very end to reveal that, like, I guess she just knows a lot of magic. Like, she comes from magic, leading us to believe that she is definitely from the same universe, at least, as Kiki's Delivery Service.
Yep.
This movie might take place also in the Nausicaä universe. Mm-hmm. But there's always been debate on whether it takes place before Nausicaä or after Nausicaä. And Miyazaki never really answered any of those questions.
I would assume before.
Before me, I guess. It's got some of the same animal life.
Yeah, and it has the same pilot hats.
Yeah, similar aesthetic. You can believe that, like, these groups came from the same, like, sort of.
And I think they're small. The smaller ships that Mama and Dola and the boys drive are very similar to the ones that are driven in.
Yeah, you got these dragonfly ships, ornithopters, as they call them. Mm-hmm. It's a well-realized visual world.
Yeah.
You really want to swoop around with these peeps.
I would think it was before it, because Nausicaä seems to be built on, like, junk, like, old tech.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't make sense for them to still be using the old tech in a world where it seems like things are improving.
Right. However, this movie is also built on old tech, so.
Mm-hmm. Everything's old tech. Nothing improves.
It's all old tech. So she falls to the ground. She's found by the boy Pazu. Patsu? Pazu?
Patsu.
Patsu?
I think so.
And he works in a mining town. He's a miner.
He is a miner.
Everyone's very busy. They're all mining. They're on the verge of starvation because there's no silver in the mine.
They have the best meatballs.
There's some food in this movie, too. Okay, so Patsu makes himself lunch. And what does his lunch end up being? It sounds so simple.
Which one?
The one that he shares with Sheeta.
Egg and bread.
Fried egg on bread. Mm-hmm. How thick is this bread?
It is so thick.
You've never had it, maybe. I don't think so. But there is a thing in Texas called Texas toast.
I have had Texas toast.
You've had Texas toast.
Yes.
All it is, of course, is very thick bread made into toast.
Yep.
But very thick bread. Mm-hmm. You can buy loaves of Texas toast. There's like 4 slices for a loaf.
Yeah.
No, there's more than that, but it's very thick. And that's what I always think of when I see this egg on this like thick piece of bread. Just... Mm-hmm. A chunk of bread. What if it was What if it was pound cake?
No.
Fried egg on pound cake. But that's all it is. It's egg on toast, and it looks so good.
And then when we enter the house where when Dola is like has taken over the house when she's eating all of that food, man.
Yeah. She bites into a lobster, shell and all, and it still looks good. It's still animated so well. This movie is animated so well. I was watching there's a scene on the train bridge when the bridge is collapsing underneath the train as they're running. And I was like, you didn't see things like that. Like, Disney wasn't attempting anything this complex. Even at this point, anytime they tried anything this complex, they were trying it with computers just to like save on like worker power. And Ghibli was just doing it.
Yep.
Yeah. It's amazing. So no one believes Patsu that he's found this little girl. No one has time to listen, basically. He wants to show her what her necklace can do. He jumps off a ledge and crashes into the mine below. With her necklace. This is after he's told her that his father was an aviator who died of embarrassment. He didn't die. He did die of embarrassment.
No, this is before that, because she wakes up, comes out to see what's going on. He gives her the birds. Like, he gives her bird feed so she can feed the birds. And then he's like, watch this. And like, because she lets him see her necklace, puts around his neck. And he's like, watch this, and jumps off. And then they're coming back in to clean up afterwards.
Right. That's right.
When she sees the, yeah.
That's right.
If there's one thing I'm good at, it's timelines.
We find out that his father believed in this floating city in the sky that he swore he saw and took a picture. I mean, there's a photograph of it, so I don't know why everyone was so like down on him.
Clearly, he was a Photoshop master.
He took a picture up in the clouds of this floating castle that he believed was this land called Laputa, which is kind of a legendary castle in the sky.
I mean, if you see a castle in the sky, you gotta go back to the legends, because what else is it gonna be?
And the idea is that there used to be a civilization that lived up in the clouds, essentially. And the ancient tale of Laputa is that it's basically Atlantis, but up in the sky. There was this civilization that lived in a floating city, and they got too hubristic, and they ended up all dying of disease or whatever. But the city is still up there somewhere. If you could only find it. And as human technology advances into this movie, like, it's becoming more and more likely that someone is going to run into this castle at some point. And so now we have this, the bad guy, we have this guy Muska looking for her.
I don't think that's his name.
Yeah, Colonel Muska.
Muska.
We have Muska looking for her because he wants the necklace. We have Dola and the pirates looking for her because they want the necklace, right?
Yeah, he wants her and the necklace.
Right.
Because she's the only one who can control the necklace.
And then we have the military helping out, looking for her.
They say that she's the only one who can control the necklace, but I think she's the only one who can activate the necklace.
Yeah. It all sort of converges in the town. Like, the groups all come together. And there's this huge chase sequence through the town.
Yeah, we get to see a bunch of men beating each other up, which is very funny.
Yes, it's very funny. We have Louis, Henri, and Charles, who I believe are the three main pirate guys.
I don't remember their names. I don't know if we ever learned their names.
They say them a few times. They introduce themselves at one point, and they say what their favorite food is.
Right.
But we have these pirate guys, and they're very competitive with each other. They're very funny, and they're very
Three Stooges.
Yeah, they're very Three Stooges. They're devoted to their mama. And, you know, spoiler alert, all the pirates end up becoming kind of good guys in the end.
Kind of.
They're still pirates, but you gotta love it. They mention a few times that Mama has a soft heart. Dola has a soft heart, and she just always ends up helping people and sometimes giving away their...
Dola's great. I'm still iffy on her sons.
Her sons get weird, and I think part of it has to do with the translation. Because depending on which translation you're doing, if you're looking at the subtitled version, the streamlined dub, or the Disney dub, their reactions to Sheeta once she comes on board can either be goofy or creepy. Depending on if you think they're happy to have her around because she can cook, or if you think they're happy to have her around because they're attracted to her. Bear in mind, she's 11 years old.
Yeah. And I think that this dub definitely went a bit more on the latter.
Yeah, they kept calling her beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I believe the idea is that they're just being led around by their stomachs. They're just, mm-hmm. they're enamored of her because she knows how to cook and all they want to do is eat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, that's fine. This dub, though, bit weird.
So they end up running. They end up floating down into the bottom of a mine shaft where they meet Uncle Pom.
The best character. I said that about several characters, but.
Yeah. Uncle Pom, who is, who's an old miner who doesn't live. They're like, Sheeta's like, do you live down here? And he's like, no, I don't live down here, but I hardly ever go above here.
And he talks to the rocks.
He talks to the rocks. And what are the rocks telling him?
Shimmy shiny. I don't know. Something weird's going on.
Yeah, he came down there because the rocks are getting active. And the rocks they're basically made of the same stuff that her mm-hmm. necklace is.
Yeah.
And they started getting like really weird.
You would think would be profitable to mine.
Right. They started getting really weird when she came into the town, and then she takes out her necklace, and it's glowing like crazy, and he freaks out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the rock whisperer.
Yeah, and he's like, it's too much, it's too much, it's Ethereum.
It was just screaming in his ears the entire time.
But come to find out, the rock she's got is like this refined Ethereum crystal necklace, or it's like, it's been refined in a way that like no one else can do, except mm-hmm. in her hometown, the Valley of Gondoa. And that this I guess maybe the mineral is not that valuable, but it seems pretty powerful.
It could be turned into a levitation crystal.
But like only if you're the right person to activate.
Is it only in the Valley of Gondua, or is it only in Lapita
that they can refine it? Oh, yeah, I don't know.
She got it from her family, which I believe had it in Lapita.
That's true. That's true. Well, he gets knocked out and they get kidnapped by the military anyway. Mm-hmm. And she gets.
No, I thought he walked away before they got kidnapped by the military.
No, he gets knocked out and they both get taken to the military.
Oh, not Uncle Pom.
No, Uncle Pom's out of the movie at this point.
Yeah.
Sheeta and Patsu get kidnapped by the military and she gets shown one of our friendly robots.
Mm-hmm. We also have the most terrifying scene in this movie in this place.
Which is?
When Patsu's trying to look out the window.
Yeah, describe that for our friendly listeners.
So you know how, like, people die when they go, cave climbing and stuff?
I do know how they die.
Because they, like, get stuck in a place that's way too narrow?
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what this is.
Did you know that when people get lost in the woods, they mostly, when they die, because they're lost in the woods, they usually die of shame?
I don't believe you.
Sorry, that's from the movie The Edge. They mostly die of shame because they get lost and they're embarrassed.
But
and
he like
give up.
Squeezes his face and then gets stuck. Mm-hmm. And it's so awful.
Yeah. He squeezes his face into this narrow gap and then he momentarily can't get it back out. And yeah, that's like my horror show. That's a horror show.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he gets it back out. Don't worry, everyone.
Do we see him get it back out?
Yeah.
He
pulls it out. He pulls it out.
Okay. I remember he gets stuck and we see him like struggling and then the scene cuts back to Sheeta.
Yeah, we see him pull it out. Okay. So what's going on is this guy, our bad guy, whatever his name is, I can never remember his name, Muska, shows Sheeta this robot that fell from the sky and they don't know how to turn it on. It's in a couple of pieces. It's a giant robot, but he's like, I think this thing came from Lapita. And we find out that she's told Patsu that she is a descendant of the royal family of Lapita. Mm-hmm. And that the necklace she wears has been passed down in her family for generations. Mm-hmm. So Muska believes that she can use this necklace to find the lost city of Lapita and mm-hmm. basically like activate the technology.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because she has like she is like the blood descendant of the original royal family. Mm-hmm. We'll learn more about Muska later.
Yeah.
And his like actual intent behind this. But yeah, when the necklace turns on, it points a light into the sky that guides you to Lapita. It also turns on the robot, as we find out later.
Yeah, because I think she cast the protection spell.
Mm-hmm.
Or she asked to be protected when she was when she activated the necklace or something.
Yeah. Because she activates the necklace and it wakes up the robot.
And also, like, does a bunch of cool light effects and then burns Muska or something.
Right.
It's very cool. It's a lot of fun.
But first, that's after Patsu gets asked to leave. He gets told, she gets told, "I'll kill your little friend if you don't help me." So he gets asked to leave, and she pretends not to need him because she doesn't want him to get hurt.
He gets paid 3 gold coins.
Yeah.
Chuck E. Cheese tokens.
Yeah, they give him 3 gold coins for his pains. He's humiliated. He's ashamed of his leaving. He almost throws the gold. In one of my favorite scenes in the movie, he almost throws the gold coins away, but then he doesn't because it's still 3 gold coins. Mm-hmm. But then he gets home, and the pirates are there eating the lobster.
And he's like, "Excuse me, this is my house."
Yeah. And they all decide to go rescue Sheeta. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the pirates, because they want the treasure.
And he's like, they're planning on leaving him behind, but he soft hard, like they said.
Yeah. He demands to go. He's also helpful. He can repair a ship, mm-hmm, or whatever. By this point, the robot has woken up and begins like destroying everything in its path.
Melting everything into lava.
Yeah, in an attempt to protect Sheeta. It's mm-hmm, trying to save her. The robot ends up getting killed, actually. And I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is
very sad.
Yeah. It's just trying to save her, and it gets like a bomb dropped on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the giant airship comes back, flies in to protect their property, and drops a bomb on it. But the pirates and Patsu end up saving Sheeta and getting her way onto the pirate ship.
She does not have the necklace anymore, though.
Yes, you're right. She loses the necklace. Dun, dun, dun. And this becomes your favorite part, where she gets a makeover.
Yes. Pirate pants.
Mm-hmm.
I love the pants.
Yeah, up until this point, we've only seen her in long dresses. We've seen her in a black dress. We've seen her in a white dress. Dola is like, "You got to dress properly," because she keeps, also they're up in the sky and it looks like her dress is going to carry her away.
It does.
It's just constantly billowing up. And I'm like, God, like a slightly stronger wind and we're going to lose our heroine.
It'll do that thing that happened when I was really little and you handed me the umbrella outside the library and started, mm-hmm, blowing me away.
Yep, it's going to carry you away like a reverse Mary Poppins. And this is where we find out that Sheeta's learned a bunch of magic spells from her grandmother, and that one
she's
is
also apparently a good navigator.
Yes, and that one is a spell of destruction.
Mm-hmm. That's just dropped there.
Yeah,
yeah. I learned some destruction magic. Also magic, apparently.
It's kind of like in Harry Potter when they learn like the 4 curses, the 4 mm-hmm, like forbidden curses or whatever, and you're like, got to teach those kids how to kill each other with words so yep, they know never to do it.
They could have just stopped teaching that.
Right.
Well, I guess a Death Eater was teaching the class at that point, so that would make sense, but I don't think that was generally in the Hogwarts curriculum of normal things to teach your magical students.
Right. We then, Patsu and Sheeta go up in the lookout gondola, which is basically a crow's nest attached to a rope that is attached to a kite that flies above the pirates. The pirate's ship, by the way, is called the Tiger Moth, and it flies above the Tiger
really
Moth.
Really good soup first, though.
He does. She does. Yes. Yeah, she makes really good soup, and the other pirates lust after the soup, we hope.
We hope. We pray.
Yes.
We beg.
So they're up there. They get set upon by the Goliath, the military, and a huge, very long battle ensues, mm-hmm, between the Tiger Moth and the Goliath, but also the gondola is still up. And
does this pirate ship not have any guns on it?
They have their little, I think the guns are all on their little pirate ship. They're They're little tiny flyers. I don't know.
Right.
I think it does.
I don't think we ever see the pirate ship fire a weapon.
There's only a few of them, and they're always busy flying those little flyers.
Yeah.
So while the battle is happening, they also encounter this huge storm.
Mm-hmm.
Which
snake storm. Dragon's nest.
Yes, it's filled. Yes, it's called the Dragon's Nest. It's tall. It's like this. It's like pyramid-shaped thunderhead.
Mm-hmm.
It is dragon lightning, isn't it?
It's snake lightning. They don't have wings. They don't have arms. They're just oblong serpents.
But the dragon's nest is how Patsu's father referred to the cloud where he first saw Laputa.
You'd think if there was like a specific cloud, it would be pretty easy to find without the necklace.
I think though, and it's one thing that like, I think what's happened is flight, while a thing in this world isn't common, like the military has it, the pirates have it, the sky is huge, and Laputa is really high up.
Oh, also, I think, like, at some point, it was made clear that the reason it was so easy to find this time was because Laputa was answering the call of the crystal after she activated it.
Right, it's coming after her.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's usually very high in the sky.
Do you think if she stayed on Earth, it would just, like, slowly get closer and then just
crush
the countryside?
I wonder if it would, like, yeah, just smash into the land. But at this point, it is still just a giant storm cloud that is sucking them all in. Patsu is like, wait a minute, I think this is actually Laputa. So he's like, send us into the storm. And the pirates are like, what? And he's like, they go into the storm.
They do go into the storm. The pirates don't really have control over it at that point, though.
Right. Their little air gondola breaks loose. They get sucked into the storm, and they wake up in a beautiful field.
Mm-hmm. They're still tied together.
Because they're tied together, by the way.
Yeah.
And they're so happy to be there that they can't even untie themselves. And Patsu picks up Sheeta and spins her around right on the edge of a cliff.
They almost fall off.
Yes. I'm like, what are you doing, son? You don't have to do it.
This kid is the strongest child.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a minor boy.
No, yeah. It's completely understandable why he's so strong. But I think he's stronger than the adults in this movie.
Yeah. Certainly emotionally stronger.
Most children are.
Well, spoiler alert, they have crash landed on Laputa. They're it's a beautiful castle of ruins surrounded by fields and flowers and birds. And all of a sudden, one of those giant robots shows up and picks up their gondola, and they think it's going to crush it. But what does it do?
It moves it.
Why?
Because there's a bird's nest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is this a sentient robot?
What do you mean?
Like, did this robot, like, because we see the robot at the end is, like, still hanging out with the birds. Like, they watch, like, we see him as they fly away. So he didn't answer the call to action like the other robots did.
Interesting. Well, maybe there's, like, guard robots and gardener robots.
Maybe.
Caretaker robots. I don't know if they're sentient. I think it's sadder to think of the fact that they are just there doing their job, waiting for their creators to return, which they never will.
Yeah, because all the other bots that were in the garden area are gone.
Right. They've all shut down. They're covered in grass and moss.
Mm-hmm. This guy's also covered in grass and moss, but he's still alive.
Yeah, he's doing a good job. They go and they search. They find this beautiful garden. They find a family of fox squirrels from from Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind.
I have a thing to say once we get to the end of this movie.
They're very emotional. It's a very emotional scene. This land is beautiful. And then all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose because the military has shown up and it's starting to blow up crap.
As the military does wherever it goes.
They're just blowing up walls.
They're trying to, anyways.
They could probably find doors, but they're just blowing up walls.
There was a door, but they couldn't all get in at once, so they decided to blow it up instead.
There's so much gold everywhere, and they're still, like, blowing stuff up to find more gold. I'm like, just get the gold you see first, then look inside other doorways.
Then open the door, and you can move it without having to waste all of your explosives.
Right. There's all these treasure rooms, and the military is there to get all the treasure out of the treasure rooms. The pirates have been captured. They're all tied up. Now, Patsu and Sheeta get separated because Muska shows up and tries to kill Patsu.
Yeah, and Sheeta's not having it.
No.
Well, they get separated because Patsu does the dumbest thing in the world.
Oh, yeah. What does he do?
See if
you can explain this.
So they're at the edge, and they're trying to get across to, like, a landing. And Patsu's like, I'll go first. And she's just like, maybe don't. Doesn't look very... He jumps. It crumbles.
Of course
it does. Oh, no, it's crumbling. And
but it's not just a landing. It's suspended. It's hanging.
Yeah. Over the ocean.
Yeah. It's like a pillar below Laputa with a little ledge around it that he could jump on. But the ledge immediately, just falls apart.
It immediately crumbles, and he climbs up more, and then that part crumbles, and he climbs up more, and then that part crumbles.
Right.
And then he climbs up more.
He barely makes it to safety, and then he gets shot in the face.
Yeah, he gets shot in the face, and Sheeta goes and tackles someone.
And then Patsu finds the pirates, who he cuts free, and they give him Hellboy's gun.
Yep.
They give him a gun. This is what you were talking about, how Patsu is the strongest boy in the world. Apparently he can fire this gun without being blown backwards into the wall.
It is a cannon. It is a mini cannon.
It is a literal hand cannon. Yep. It fires shells the size of his fist.
Yeah.
For no reason, too, because he ends up, it never really works out for him. It's
he
not
uses it to blow open the wall so he can squeeze through, like, the thing from X-Files in that one episode.
It's barely a useful gun. Yes, he is like the X-Files monster. All right, so Muska and Sheeta, Muska's dragon Sheeta to the center of Laputa.
Also his other two Secret Service agents.
We find out, yes, who don't come to a good end. In the center of Laputa is where all the weird tech is coming to life. A lot of cubes that float around, I guess.
Floating cubes. That's how computers work, right?
Yeah, and we find this, there's an Ethereum crystal at the heart of Laputa that kind of powers everything. And of course, he's like, if I get this crystal, I'll be the richest man in the world. And she's like, "Why? How do you know all this?" And he's like, "Haha, you thought you were the only descendant, but I am also a descendant. I am a descendant of the royal family of Laputa."
Just the opposite royal family of Laputa, because apparently they separated into two families.
Yeah, like branched off at some point.
Yeah. And she's like, "Why are you being such a jerk then?"
Yeah. So
he goes through the tallest grass, and he's very angry about all the vines.
Yeah, because this whole thing, like the crystal and everything, is all overgrown with roots and vines and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Because there's a giant tree.
Yeah. He also, his plan is to double cross the military.
Well, who wouldn't when you see them?
Yeah. And how does he double cross them?
He murders them all.
He wakes up all the robots who proceed to murder the entire military.
Yeah. Well, first he calls them into like a bay. It looks like a ship bay.
Yeah.
With big glass windows. And is a hologram, and then he gets shot at because the military can't see through things, apparently.
Yeah, he's clearly a hologram, and yeah, they try to kill him.
And then he vents them all.
Yeah, yes. And then the robots come, and everything blows up, and everyone dies. Yeah.
Luckily, the pirates didn't leave at that point, because they would have been murdered.
Mm-hmm. So Sheeta gets free, and she runs off. Mm-hmm. She has the crystal with her, and so so he gives chase. So Patsu and Sheeta run into each other, but there's a wall separating them, mm-hmm. and there's like a crack in the wall.
Yeah.
And so she passes the stone through the crack to him, mm-hmm. and says like, "Don't lose this." And how does he not lose it?
He puts it in his mouth.
Which is the. It is a small crystal.
Yeah, and he's going. There's like explosions going on everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, and he has so many pockets.
Uh huh.
He has so many pockets. You can just put it in one of those.
Right.
No, he sticks it in his mouth and then shoots a gun.
Mm-hmm. With massive recoil, which probably would have caused him to swallow the stone in real life. But he shoots. Yes. Yeah, he shoots the hole that he reached through before so that he can crawl through. They get to the throne room. Muska and takes Sheeta there.
He shoots off her pigtails.
He literally shoots off her pigtails.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as a threat.
Which is terrifying.
But amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we find out that what happened to Laputa was that if you live up in the sky, and this is very Miyazaki, you can't live in the sky. You have to have connection to the earth below you,
mm-hmm.
Which is one of the reasons why, like, Laputa, I think, is, like, shown, like, just growing these like, incredibly long roots.
Yeah.
Like, it's trying to reach the earth again.
Mm-hmm.
And we find out that Laputa's people just left Laputa. Because they were like, this sucks. And they like went back to the earth.
She has a whole, like, there's like a whole song about it or poem or something.
Yeah.
She gives.
He's going to kill, Muska's going to kill the little girl, kill Sheeta. So Patsu's like, if you kill her, you're never going to get the crystal. I'll make sure you never.
Hidden it somewhere. And for some reason, he believes the boy.
Yeah. And then Muska makes the worst decision a villain could ever make. Patsu says, you can kill us or whatever, but please just give us 3 minutes in private to like say goodbye to each other or whatever. And so he does. He's like, great, take you 3 minutes. And I'm like, villain, don't you realize this is where they're going to come up with their plan?
I mean, that's the thing about children is that people like underestimate them,
I guess. Well,
also, that's the thing about this guy. I think he is the personification of hubris in this movie.
True.
Like,
true.
I think he's meant to represent what caused the downfall of Laputa, and she's meant to represent why, like, the other end of that, like, there's the one who, like, wants to go back to Laputa because he wants to take everything for himself. And she's like, Laputa didn't work. So I want to stand. Like, I don't know. I think there's some symbolism going on between the two of them, obviously.
Well, the real symbolism is that they're like, Patsu's like, hey, remember that spell of destruction you never wanted to do? Teach it to me, and we'll say it together while holding hands. And so they do. And it blows up Laputa.
It blows up the bottom half of Laputa.
Yeah, yeah. Fortunately, they're flying over the ocean.
Do you think all of that treasure is now just in the ocean?
Oh, I'm sure.
Does that mean there's going to be like hundreds of people flocking to the ocean trying to get treasure now, and it's going to turn into another bloodbath?
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, the military's gone, so less of a bloodbath, I suppose.
The thing is, the entire military's gone.
Not the entire military.
I know, but like
just a huge chunk.
A huge chunk of the military is dead. If this, okay. Well, let's get to this at the end. So what happens is the bottom part of Laputa falls into the ocean. What's mostly left is the top part of the castle, but mostly the tree, this giant tree.
Yeah.
That you realize is like the tree that's holding the whole thing together.
Yeah, there's a lot of structure left as well. It's still a ruin, the ruins of a city, because I think most of what was destroyed was the beneath, like the place where the crystal was held.
Yeah.
And like where all the technology and stuff was.
Well, Muska doesn't make it. He falls into the ocean. So do all the robots. Mm-hmm. But the roots of the tree save our two heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the pirates who are still alive, who have escaped, notice that the giant crystal is glowing inside. Mm-hmm. You can see the crystal now through the roots of the tree.
Yeah.
So they believe that means that Sheeta's still alive, so they go to rescue the kids, which they do.
Well, no, they don't, because the kids get out with the glider.
Well, don't they get together with the pirates at the end, though?
They do. They get together with the pirates. Yeah. The pirates are arguing about whether or not to go back to find the kids. And
oh, that's right. I forgot. They forgot the glider survived.
Yeah, the glider magically survived and fell right next to them.
We found out the pirates did get some of the treasure away from Laputa. It's very much like the end of the Goonies, where you think, well, they lost all the treasure, but then like, oh no, wait, there's some in Mikey's marble bag. But they have more than a marble bag full. They hid it all over themselves. But
it's a shame they lost all of the treasure that was on their ship, though.
It is a shame. Mm-hmm. But as the kids are like, well, I'm gonna take Sheeta back to her home so she can hang out with her yaks again.
Mm-hmm. What is with this movie and like just letting kids run farms on their own?
Hey, they're poor. They got to run something. And as they're flying, they pass Laputa and they see that the gardener robot is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Taking care of the gardens, taking care of the birds, taking care of the fox squirrels, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And over the closing credits, you see the Laputa's flown to Saturn, I guess.
So I have a question about that, actually.
Okay.
They're in space now.
Who's they?
The Laputa is in space. Okay. Doesn't that mean every single living creature on that thing is dead?
I don't think they're actually in space. I think
it looks like they've left the atmosphere of the planet.
I think it's supposed to suggest that they are very high up.
Wouldn't that still kill most of the things, though?
Yes, it would. Yes, it would definitely. They're all dead.
It's just and it keeps going up forever because, well, until it hits like the place where gravity is much less, because levitation and no gravity don't make any sense.
What's funny, though, is that I assume there's magic involved. Mm-hmm. A, I assume there's magic involved. I assume that like the implication is that, well, I don't know. Is the implication that now Laputa is like safe from ever being discovered again? Is that like the point?
Mm-hmm. I really think the point is that there's a giant tree in the sky now. Have fun.
Now, we were expecting there to be some kind of like little like thing at the end with pictures of like him taking her back to her hometown.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the pirates scatting about, like at the end of other Ghibli films, they sometimes do that. But no, it's just this. It was just this long hold on the tree. And I was very confused. I was like, I don't remember that being how the movie ended. Like, I don't remember there being
I don't remember it either.
Just this, like, there was not even any closing credits.
Nope. There was just the song in the tree.
Right. There was just the song in the tree. So I decided to take a look because the version we watched, we did because I didn't want to watch, because I wanted to watch this dub.
Mm-hmm.
I have this movie, but I wanted to watch it with this dub. The Disney dub has closing credits.
Okay.
Over the picture of the tree.
Okay.
The version we watched just didn't, but it makes more sense with closing credits.
Yeah. Like, I didn't even have subtitles to tell me what the translation of the song was. It was just this picture of a tree.
It was, yeah. What I had done was I had turned on subtitles on my end, to compare the Disney translation with the streamlined translation.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's the end of Castle in the Sky. That is how Castle in the Sky ends. It just ends with a shot of the tree. According to the novelization, of course, which there exists, he took her back to her hometown. They didn't live together or anything. He went back to his town, but they did communicate through letters. They stayed good friends. So all of you people who, all you Patsu Shida shippers out there, sorry, everyone. They don't end up together.
Sorry, everyone. They're 11.
They're 11. They've got their whole lives ahead of them. And you never even see him flying. He talks about how he's rebuilding his own like airplane or whatever, and you never get to see him flying it, even though there is concept art of him doing that available.
Yeah.
Well,
it is an airplane made of wood, so I don't really want him to fly it.
Right. Now, the most important thing we need to discuss is Laputa juice. Laputa juice. Did you watch the Laputa juice
commercial?
I did.
Yep.
So, as part of a tie-in for this movie, a soda was produced called Laputa juice.
Okay.
And it was advertised on TV with a commercial featuring two live-action actors playing Shida and Patsu, flying in a live-action little airship, but dubbed with the voices of the Japanese actors.
Yeah.
And then on YouTube, you can see it. And it also has just a bunch of like the promo stuff for Laputa juice. I hate to tell you that Laputa juice was a horrible failure.
Oh, really? It's called Laputa juice. That doesn't sound appetizing.
Laputa juice was a flop, as it says. Many were left unsold.
I wonder if somebody still has one.
I bet someone out there has a Laputa juice can just waiting to go onto the collector's market. Laputa juice. I am sure it sounds better in Japanese. But yeah, there's whole ad campaign around it. Like all these like magazine ads and stuff, like Laputa juice. But they weren't allowed to use any footage from the movie. That's why they had to use live action people. So this movie was released into 103 theaters in Japan on August 2nd, 1986. So we're coming up on the anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
August 2nd. It made a disappointing 1.16 billion yen.
Okay.
Which was less than Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind made.
Mm-hmm.
And when they asked Miyazaki why it failed, because it was considered a failure, he said because he chose an ordinary boy who does not have special abilities as the main character. So he just thought people weren't ready for it. So it was a bomb when it came out. In the late 80s, of course, it was dubbed into English and released on UK television and on video in America. You know, I've been referring to it as the Streamline dub because Streamline released it in America. It's actually the Magnum dub. Streamline just released it, but they did not do their own dub. So,
okay,
mea culpa. I'm sorry. Everyone's probably screaming at their radios about this.
I want you to know something before we continue this conversation.
What?
You can buy a Castle in the Sky Laputa Levitation Stone with voice recognition.
Oh, no. Are you going to get one?
I don't have $50.
I don't have a voice. I don't have a voice to be recognized. In 1998, it was dubbed into English through Disney, through their like Ghibli deal. It was going to be released in theaters, but because their Ghibli releases in theaters were financial flops, they stopped doing that. And it just went straight to DVD, along with Kiki's Delivery Service and the Spirited Away release. And I bought it and gave it to you.
Yep.
On DVD.
Yep.
I
mean, as I've said, it shows it was the thing that framed the direction my art went.
Yeah, and the score was put out on LP and on CD, and Joe Hisaishi has said that it was one of the hardest scores he ever wrote. Because he said the basic concept was to make music that captures the feeling of love, dreams, and adventure. Specifically, let's make the melodic sound. The basic idea is to make it something that children can listen to and warm their hearts. It's hard to make a song that is bright and has a goodness that makes you feel like that in your heart, but I wanted to challenge convention. So he didn't want to just do action music. He wanted to do music that like actually elevated the spirit, which I think he succeeded in.
I totally agree with you.
Awesome. And yeah, and then it just and now it's considered a Ghibli classic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you like it as much this time as you did in the past?
I liked it more.
Oh yeah?
It was not my favorite Studio Ghibli film when I was younger.
Yeah.
That was held by Princess Mononoke.
Uh-huh.
Still probably is. Nausicaa Valley of the Wind in second place to be. Like, really close second place, though. What is your favorite Studio Ghibli film?
I'm not sure. I really do like this one. I also like Spirited Away a lot and Princess Mononoke a lot. Totoro, I mean, we'll be watching Totoro in just a few episodes, so...
I think there's only one movie between this one and Totoro. We should end this episode before we lose each other.
We can't, because we have to talk about what Guillermo del Toro thought about it.
I can only hear half of what you're saying.
So del Toro talks about how it changed his life. Mm-hmm. It was one of the few movies that could keep his daughter from crying. He loves the feudal gestures of Miyazaki, small character traits like his father, the father in Totoro, not being able to put a shoe on, Patsu not being able to cut the rope between himself and Shida. He loves the power of the female characters in Miyazaki films. And he, when someone asked him, at a talk back if he had ever, if Miyazaki had ever failed at anything, del Toro says, "Would you ever ask whether Picasso had gotten perspective wrong?" he considers Castle in the Air to be near perfection.
Castle in the Air?
Castle in the Sky, sorry. to be close to perfection, one of the best fantasy films of all time, so gorgeous and so formative in so many ways that he forgets, and that he loves Castle in the Sky's chase scenes, and the whole mining aesthetic. It just sounds like he just loves Castle in the Sky.
Yes.
I think that Guillermo del Toro could just, if he ever wanted to retire, he could just teach Miyazaki movies.
I would take that class.
Because, I mean, I think it's pointless to even wonder why Miyazaki loves this movie.
Why
del Toro even loves this movie. And as we said, like, this movie encompasses so much of what Miyazaki would carry on with in all of his movies, which is the love of nature versus technology, like children protagonists, girls who get caught up in adventure, kids who learn like this weird sense of maturity throughout it, but still remain children at the end of it. This the monsters that are actually like benevolent, but also like the sense of nature is more powerful than all of us. Just all of this stuff like that just like bowls you over in all of his films that are also present in things like Hellboy 2 and Blade 2 and Pan's Labyrinth and all those. Like, it's just, I don't know. Of course del Toro loves Castle in the Sky. Of course he does.
Yes. I also love Castle in the Sky.
Yes. What is our next movie?
I have no idea.
Our next movie, we get to take a trip into body horror country with the 1986 heartbreaking yet gross out classic The Fly, starring Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis. Are you ready to be afraid? Be very afraid. I hope you are.
I have always wanted to watch this movie.
It's a classic. It is one of my favorite horror films of the 80s. It's part of the powerful triumvirate of 80s remakes that include The Thing, The Blob, and The Fly, three of the best horror remakes of all time. And I'm glad that we're getting to watch at least two of them in this watch. I'm excited to watch it with you. It's a gross out classic.
Yeah, I'm excited to see it. I've always wanted to.
Fun. And a sharp right turn from Castle in the
Sky.
Then
we're going directly to My Neighbor Totoro.
And then we're going another whiplash turn back into Miyazaki country with the most gentle major motion picture ever made, My Neighbor Totoro.
Yep.
So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for sticking it out when we have these huge gaps between episodes. This won't be the last.
It won't.
But we'll get back on track sooner or later. Anything else to say, my child?
No.
All right. Well, I am Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And we'll see you when
it's del Toro time.